This is Audible.
Macmillan Audio presents A Rip Through Time by Kelly Armstrong. Read for you by Kate Hanford. Author's note. Welcome to 1869 Scotland, as written by a 2021 Canadian. Yep, I am not exactly the obvious writer for such a story, which is why my narrator, Mallory, is also a 21st century Canadian. That said, I did want to present the time period as accurately as I could, within the limitations of available data, contemporary interpretations of that data, and my admittedly modern perspective. If you share my interest in this time period, you'll find both a selected and more complete bibliography on my website. The selected version is primarily books written for a general audience, while the complete includes scholarly articles and primary sources. In cases where the primary sources differed from the secondary sources, I initially chose to follow the primary sources. However, if my early readers flagged any of those choices as seeming incorrect, I opted for the better-known variation found in secondary sources. This is a novel of historical fiction, after all. On the subject of fictional license, readers familiar with Edinburgh will note that there is no Robert Street, where I've placed Gray's townhouse. This is intentional. Also, in 1869, the Edinburgh police surgeon was Henry Littlejohn, who held that post during a long and storied career where he did memorable work in forensic science. Let's just say that Gray and MacReady would have much preferred Littlejohn to my fictional police surgeon, but that would have made for a very different story. Again, this is a work of fiction, written by an enthusiastic amateur history buff who must accept that she will make mistakes and hopes they'll be forgiven. If readers wish to point out errors, well-intended constructive corrections with academic source links are always appreciated. Chapter 1. My grandmother is dying, and I am getting coffee. I can tell myself that I'm treating the hospice nurses. I can tell myself that Nan is sleeping, and I can't do anything right now. I can tell myself that even if she woke, she would never begrudge me a 15-minute break. It doesn't matter. I crossed an ocean to be at her side for her final days, and instead I'm standing in an Edinburgh coffee shop, ordering lattes and chais as if it's just another mid-afternoon caffeine break. As if the doctor hadn't told me, 30 minutes ago, that the person I love most in the world will be dead before the weekend. The shop is overcrowded and understaffed, tempers fraying, people shifting and sniping, and I want to scream at them all to shut up and be glad for a day where a 5-minute wait is the worst thing that will happen. Instead, I'm on the phone to my mom, hunched over for some modicum of privacy. In the midst of this excruciatingly banal chaos, I am telling my mother that unless she can get here in the next 3 days, she will never see her own mother again. I want to step outside, but I've already placed my order. I want to say to hell with it and reorder elsewhere, but I left my wallet in the hospice and the 10-pound note I brought is now reduced to spare change. I want to tell Mom I'll call her back, but she's on a brief recess from court. I want so many goddamn things right now. If wishes were horses. I hear Nan saying that, and with a blink, the coffee shop glistens behind a gauze of tears. Focus, Mallory. Do not lose it. Not here. Not now. I will do everything I can to get there, Mom says. If I can't, your dad will. Dad won't want you to be alone at home if... when... I can't finish that line. Cannot. Her voice drops to a whisper, as if I'm not the only one having this very private conversation in a public place. We don't want you to be alone there either, Mal. I'm not. I'm with Nan. She inhales. And I am so, so glad of that. I'm 2 turmeric lattes, 1 masala chai, 1 dark roast, a barista calls, with the exasperation that says this isn't the first time she's announced my order. I can barely hear her over the low roar of discontent around me. Her accent doesn't help. I may have spent every childhood summer in Scotland, but as a 30-year-old cop chasing career goals, I haven't visited for more than a week in years. I step forward, phone pressed to my ear. Mom's still talking, and I'm half-listening, focused on collecting those drinks and getting the hell out of here. I make it halfway when my phone vibrates. A glance at my watch shows a number that has me cursing under my breath. It's an informant who ghosted me a month ago, one I've been desperately trying to contact for fear her silence isn't voluntary. I really need to answer this, but there is no way in hell I'm cutting Mom off, not when her voice cracks with grief and fear. I'm the lifeline to her dying mother, and I won't sever that to take a work call, however urgent. 2 turmeric, the barista shouts. Mine, I say, waving my free hand as I reach the counter. I should let you go, Mom says. Sorry, I'm just grabbing coffee for the nurses. My phone continues vibrating as I shove cups into a cardboard tray. Can I call you back in 60 seconds? Tonight is fine, hun. Really, I can... Tonight, Mal. I need to get back in court anyway. She signs off. I hit the answer button to connect my informant as I slam the last cup in the tray. I'm opening my mouth as I turn to go, and I crash into a man standing right behind me. The coffee tray hits his chest. I stagger backward just in time to avoid dumping 4 cups of hot liquid on him. Droplets still splatter his white shirt. Oh my God, I say, twisting to set the tray down. I am so sorry. That's quite all right, he says. In Canada, there is a warmth to such reassurances. Here, it seems as if they're mandatory, spoken with a cool efficiency that always throws me off balance. No, it's not okay, I say, handing him a wad of napkins. Let me... He jerks back, as if I were about to touch him. I'm fine, he says. And again, the words are cool. No annoyance, no anger. Just the sense that he is terribly busy and wishes I would stop talking, please. He moves up to the counter, placing his order as he plucks napkins and dabs his shirt. I hesitate, but an older woman beside me whispers, "He's all right, dear. You go on now. Enjoy your drink before it gets cold." I nod and murmur my thanks. That's when I realize I'm still holding my cell phone. I glance down to see my informant has hung up. It's night now. My grandmother is asleep. The nurse warned she might never wake up, and I am not certain that is a bad thing. I want more time, so much more time. But she's so confused and in so much pain that a tiny part of me hopes she will not wake, and a tinier part wonders whether that is for her sake or mine. I told the hospice nurse I was going for a jog, but really I'm running away as fast as I can, and every footfall on the pavement drives a dagger of guilt through my heart. I should be at Nan's side, and instead I'm fleeing her death as if the Reaper dogged my own heels. I'm in the grass market. I remember Mom telling me how she volunteered at a homeless shelter here during uni. It's long gone, and pubs line the street now. It's much too busy for jogging, even at this hour. After fielding catcalls and dodging tourists, I find a quieter street lined with funky little shops, all long closed for the night. I pass a tourist trap with a hangman's noose painted on the window, which reminds me that the grass market had been the site of executions. Nan took me to the shadow of the gibbet when it was first unveiled maybe 10 years ago. There's an old memorial plaque to commemorate some of the executed, and during a renovation, the city had installed dark cobblestones nearby in the shape of a gibbet. Neither Nan nor I has ever been a keen student of history, but when it comes to the macabre, we're there. As I wonder where exactly that spot is, I catch a flicker of movement. I spin so sharply that my sneaker squeaks. An empty street stretches before me. At another flicker, I lift my gaze to a cigar shop flag fluttering half-heartedly in the night breeze. I roll my shoulders and stretch in place, with one foot braced against the storefront. I drink in the smell of a recent rain and the faint odor of cigars. When I listen, there is only the wind, tripping along the narrow street. I am alone with my grief and my regret and my rage and my guilt, the last one slipping away as I acknowledge how much I needed this break, a chance to run myself to exhaustion, letting tears dry on my face, a chance to lower my guard and gather my thoughts, and then return to face the horror of my grandmother's death. I finish my stretches and gaze out on the street as a long exhale hisses between my teeth. It is lovely here. Peaceful and quiet and beautiful in a haunting way. I want to linger, but I have what I came for, a sliver of solitude, and it's time to head back. I'm lunging into a run when a woman yelps. My first reaction is no reaction at all. It may be quiet, but there are people around. That playful yelp only makes me long for a moment that is, for now, beyond my grasp. I can't even recall the last time I went to a bar with friends. No one on their deathbed ever wished they spent more time in the office. Nan's admonition from last Christmas creeps up my spine. She was right, of course. If something happened to me tonight, a slip and fall or drunk driver, would I regret not making the major crimes section? Or regret the fact it's been 6 damn months since I had dinner with friends? A year since I went on a date, and even that was more hookup than romantic evening. I could swear that first cry sounded playful, like a woman being surprised by a friend. But when it comes again, it's a stifled shriek. A shriek of delight? A woman out for the evening, a little tipsy, goofing around with friends? Maybe. But I still strain to hear more, just in case. Muffled whispers, the scuff of shoes on cobblestones, then silence. I pivot towards the sounds as my hand drops toward the holster I am obviously not wearing. Blame 5 years of patrol duty, with a preference for long nights and rough neighborhoods. The sounds came from down a narrow lane ahead. I roll my steps as I ease that way, and my fingers itch for the knife I carry when I jog at home. My fingers close around my phone instead. I pull it out, ready to call 911. 911? Wrong country. What is the emergency number here? Damn it, I should know that. I'm sure Mom and Nan and even Dad all hammered it into my head when I was young. 511? No, that's traffic information at home. 411. Directory assistance. My thumb grazes the screen, but my eyes stay fixed ahead. Get a better idea of what I'm facing, and then I'll pause to search for the local number. As I approach the end of the lane, I clutch my phone in one hand. In the event of urgent trouble, I'll dial 911 and pray it forwards to an emergency service. I don't expect to need that, though. The closer I draw to the lane, the more I'm convinced that I'm about to interrupt an intimate moment. The woman's date had surprised her and made her shriek. They'd goofed around and then whispered together, and then it fell to silence as they settled into a private spot. That doesn't mean I turn around. I've rousted couples in dark alleys because what I heard didn't quite sound consensual. Half the time, I've been right. I ease into a shop alcove. At the first indication of shared passion, I'll scoot. I hear nothing, though. Maybe they've moved on, seeking true privacy. A whimper. I press my hand to the wall and lean as far as I dare, my eyes half shut as I strain to listen. A muffled sound, one I can't make out. Damn it. Give me a little more. I lift my phone and open the browser. I'm halfway through typing Scotland emergency phone number when a cry comes, a stifled word that is unmistakable. Help! Then another cry, this one of pain and surprise, and I bolt from my spot before I realize what I'm doing. I swing into the lane to see nothing. It's more alley than lane, stacked with boxes and bins for trash pickup. The cobblestones stretch into darkness, and I race along them, following the whimpers and muffled cries of a woman, until I reach the back corner and look around it to see an empty lane. It's a narrow alleyway between the rows of shops, and there is nothing in sight. I squint into darkness lit only by a single flickering lamp over a door. Even without better lighting, I am absolutely certain there's no one here. They must have moved on. I misunderstood, and the couple moved on. I'm turning away when a gasp sounds behind me. I spin, fists rising, to see that empty expanse of alley again. Then there's a flicker, the shifting of light, a flash of cornflower blue hovering like a haze. The haze becomes a dress, a long dress, half translucent, a glimpse of light hair. Then another gasp, as the wisp of a figure falls back against the wall, only to disappear as she strikes it. What the hell? I blink hard. A projection? It must be. Some kind of video projection from a tour. A young woman in an old-fashioned dress, struck down by an unseen assailant. I peer up at the opposite wall, looking for the malfunctioning projector. Something moves behind me. Do I catch the whisper of a foot on stone? The smell of another body? Or just a shift in air pressure? Nan would call it a sixth sense, but all I know is that my gut says, "Turn around, now," and I obey. I wheel just as something swings toward my head. I spin out of the way and catch a glimpse of rough rope gripped in a man's hand. Synapses fire, a connection made. An article glimpsed in passing. Edinburgh. Two bodies found in the past month, strangled. Old rope around their necks. A spark of realization, smothered by the far more important fact that I am being attacked. This is not a malfunctioning ghost tour video. My arm smacks up into his and he staggers back, grunting in shock. His face rises, hidden in the shadow of a dark hoodie. Then the hood falls half back and it's the man from the coffee shop. The man I spilled coffee on. If asked what he looked like, I'd have said I had no idea. I only saw his shirt front dappled with coffee droplets. But I never ask witnesses whether they would recognize someone if they saw them again, because half the time they'll say no. But if I put a lineup before them, the memory will slam back. That's what happens now. I thought I didn't see his face earlier. But then this man looks at me. White guy, mid-30s, average face, light hair, dark eyes. And I know him. I know him beyond any doubt. I spilled a few drops of coffee on some suit in a crowded shop, and now he's in this alley, dressed in a black hoodie with a length of fraying rope in his hand. It makes no sense, and that is where I fail. My foot was flying up to kick him, and then I recognized him and I falter. He faints out of my way. I stumble and twist to right myself, and in a blink, the rope is around my neck. I claw to get my fingers under it as 20 thoughts explode at once. 20 instructions, and above all of them, the scream that I should do better. I've taught women how to fight off an attacker in every situation. And here I am, uselessly clawing at a rope already around my neck. It happened so fast. It happened so goddamn fast, and part of me screams a curse for every time I calmly told some woman how to fight this. Get your fingers under whatever is choking you. Free some air. Claw, kick, punch, scream. Scream. I can't breathe. How the hell can I scream? I do claw. But the rope is already digging in, my nails shredding against it. I kick backward. Rear kick, side kick, roundhouse kick. I know them all, but my foot never makes contact. Even when I manage to get my hand behind my neck, all I feel is that length of rope. He hasn't said a word, hasn't made a sound. My sneakers scuff against the stone, and I'm gasping, the world tinging red at the edges. I am suffocating. I am going to die, and there isn't a goddamn thing I can do about it. Fight. That's what I can do. Fight in any way possible. My kicking foot finally makes contact. Hard contact. The man grunts and staggers, and I get my balance again. I throw myself forward, but he's already recovered, wrenching me off balance. The man yanks again, as if growing impatient. I am taking so long to die. I twist, and down the alley two figures shimmer. A young woman with honey blonde hair, in a cornflower blue dress, as a shadowy figure has his hands wrapped around her throat. The figures vanish, and I fight anew, but I'm off balance, and can't do more than flail. I'm sorry, Nan. I'm sorry I won't be with you. I know I promised. The world goes dark. Chapter 2. I wake on a bed. It's not exactly soft, but considering what just happened to me, I'd be happy with a stone pallet. Better than a wooden casket. There's a rough pillow under my head and a stiff coverlet over me. A hospital? When I crack open my eyes, pain trumpets through my skull, and I shut them again. My ribs feel tight, as if they've been bound. Nothing else hurts, though. I'm wearing what feels like a hospital gown, tugging at me when I move. The room is chilly and damp. When I breathe in, there's the smell of camphor? That's the word that comes to mind, though I'm not even sure what camphor is. Something medicinal. Definitely a hospital, then. Definitely? It seems very quiet for a hospital. No footsteps on linoleum floors. No creaking of gurney or supply cart wheels. No blipping of machines or whisper of voices. I try peeking again, but the pain forces me into retreat. I survived. That's all that matters. A man lured me in with that video, and I fell for it. Someone must have heard the noise and rescued me. In the alley, I'd remembered an article sent by a colleague, a fellow detective who also had his eye on advancement. According to the article, two bodies had been found in Edinburgh, possibly the baby steps of a nascent serial killer. My colleague joked that maybe I could investigate it and become a homicide detective with Scotland Yard. I hadn't had the heart to tell him that Scotland Yard isn't in Scotland. Let's just say one of us has a better chance of climbing the law enforcement ladder than the other. I'd only skimmed the article, and mostly just to reassure myself that I wouldn't risk becoming victim number three. The victims had been a middle-aged man, killed midday in his car, and an elderly woman murdered in her garden. While the murder weapon, old hemp rope, suggested a connection, the police suspected the victims themselves would end up being connected. Targeted killings, rather than the thrill-motivated actions of a serial killer. A visitor out for a jog was in no danger at all, unless she spilled coffee on the killer. I'm still trying to wrap my head around that. I was targeted for murder, not because I had a life insurance policy or a long-standing feud with a neighbor. I was targeted for an everyday offense, an accident for which I sincerely apologized and tried to make amends. Part of me is laughably offended. Plenty of time to dwell on that later. For now, my colleague's joke might actually come true, at least the part about me helping in a homicide investigation. I have critical information on a serial killer, a face emblazoned in my memory, a motive, as mind-boggling as it might be, a potential location, as the man's jacketless dress shirt had suggested he worked in a nearby office. I know what he looks like, and how he chooses his victims, and where police can start canvassing for an ID. It'd be much more impressive if I learned that as a cop, rather than a victim. No matter. At least I hadn't actually died. Nan. I leave her up in bed, my head and stomach lurching together as I swallow bile. I gag and then force myself to slow down. If I vomit, they'll keep me in the hospital. I need to get to Nan. Everything else can wait. The room is dark. I blink in case my eyes are still closed. They aren't. My head booms, and thoughts flit like fireflies, sparks of light that disappear before I can catch them. Something's wrong. Hospital rooms aren't this dark. How many times has Nan grumbled about that? Even in the middle of the night, there's so much light. I'm not in a hospital. I scramble from the bed, the damned gown binding my legs and nearly toppling me face first to the floor. While my outfit might feel like restraints, I'm not actually bound. Also, as my eyes adjust, I can make out a sliver of harsh light under a door. I'm standing on a lumpy carpet, but in one step, I'm on ice-cold wood. I catch smells I don't recognize. There's that one that keeps whispering, camphor. The word strikes me as old-fashioned. Maybe something from Nan's house? Nan. I squeeze my eyes shut. Great. My thoughts have metamorphosed from lazily fluttering fireflies to a hive of bees buzzing about, stingers at the ready. Slow down. Step one, open the door. I make it two more paces before the damn gown tangles up my legs and I stumble. Why the hell does this hospital gown reach my ankles? It takes longer than it should for that question to form. Proof that my brain is still muddled. I tug at the garment. It's more like a nightgown. And there's something under it, something that stops me from breathing deeply. I run my hands up my sides. Am I wearing a corset? Holy shit, I'm wearing a corset and a nightgown. Also, some kind of wig. I can feel hair against my back where it normally falls on my shoulders. I'm not safely in a hospital. My attacker has taken me hostage, strangled me until I lost consciousness, and brought me to some, I'd say, lair, if that didn't sound so comic book villain. I've been taken captive and dressed in a gown and a corset and a wig. I am suddenly terrified of the answer to the question, where the hell am I? There might be a serial killer in Edinburgh, but that's not who jumped me. This is a whole other kind of attack. The kind that turns the stomach of even seasoned detectives. Breathe, Mallory. Just breathe. I do. I rein in the galloping terror and take deep breaths. Go back to step one. Try to open the door. I take two steps toward the sliver of light, only to tangle in the skirt again, and I stagger forward, hands slamming down on something hard that twists my wrist and has me uttering a string of curses. A distant gasp, then running footsteps. I back up, fists rising. The door swings open and that harsh light floods in, making my head shriek, my eyes half shutting, giving me only the barest glimpse of the newcomer. It's a girl, no more than 12, backlit by that white light, her edges blurred by my throbbing head. She's holding something like a toy sand bucket. My brain refuses to process. I see a young girl, and considering what I fear has happened to me, I can only think she must be another victim. But she's out and about, running around the house with a toy. I swallow and force myself to remain calm. "Hey, kid," I say, my voice coming out weirdly pitched. I don't know where I am, but could you help? She screams, drops the bucket, and races back down the hall. I stand there, staring after her. It's only as she flees that my mind finishes processing her image. 12-year-old girl with brown hair and eyes, a smattering of freckles and a thin frame. Her hair was swept up under a strange little cap, one that matched a dress that looked like something out of a historical drama. Simple and blue, with a matching white apron. I stare down at the bucket, It's made of wooden slats with iron rings, and its contents puddle on the floor. Steaming water that carries one of the smells from my room, a medicinal, tar-like scent. I lift my gaze to the hall. It's a corridor of gold damask wallpaper, the sort I remember from my great-grandmother's house. There's a light right outside my room, a brass fixture on the wall, spitting white flame. I take another step back, smacking into whatever I hit earlier. It's a cabinet, the top holding a ceramic bowl and jug and a small pedestal mirror. The cabinet is a dark red wood, the two doors held closed by a brass medallion engraved with a Chinese dragon. My gut squeezes, nausea rising. I've been kidnapped and thrown into someone's sick fantasy version of a Victorian home, complete with a poor kid forced to play the role of maid. The nausea solidifies into anger as I inhale again. Okay, whatever this is, I can handle it. And I can help that girl. I just need to figure out what's going on and play along. Help the child, catch this bastard, save myself. As I straighten, my gaze lifts to the mirror, to my reflection in it, and the blonde girl from the alley stares back. Chapter 3. I stand in front of the cabinet, staring at the reflection of the blonde girl from the alley. The obvious answer is that I'm looking at another projection. I don't even get a chance to consider that because my first reaction is to jerk back, startled. And the girl in the mirror moves with me. Bruises dapple her neck, and there's a dressing on her temple as if she'd been struck there. And my mind goes instantly to the alley, hearing her gasp and fall back, seeing hands around her throat. The girl, young woman, I should say, is no more than 20. Honey blonde hair that curls to mid-back, bright blue eyes, average height with curves not quite contained by the corset over my chest. Not me. None of it is me. I take a deep breath. Or I try to, but the corset restricts the movement. I look down to see I'm wearing a dress. A long-sleeved cotton dress, not unlike the one on the little girl who fled. When I run my hands over the bodice, I feel stiff stays beneath. Who puts an injured young woman to bed while wearing a dress and corset? I almost laugh at my outrage, as if this young woman is a stranger and I'm incensed on her behalf. This stranger is me. Footsteps thump up the stairs, heavy, floor-creaking steps with lighter ones pattering along. My head jerks up and I lunge, only to inhale sharply as the corset tightens. I gather my skirts, a phrase I've never had cause to use before, and race to the door, easing it shut before the people reach the top of the stairs. A few moments later, someone turns the knob and I brace my back against the door. "Katrina," a woman says, "open this door." I close my eyes and lean against it, and I have no idea what I'm doing, only that I do not want to face anyone until I've figured out what the hell is going on. "Are you certain she's awake, Alice?" the woman asks. A girl's voice says,
"Aye, ma'am. She were on her feet and talking, although what she said. Her mind must be addled fae the blow."
The older woman grumbles,
"We dinna need this."
I struggle to follow the accents, which seem thicker than I'm used to in Edinburgh. My brain smooths their speech into something I can follow.
"Katrina," the older woman says.
I clear my throat and channel historical novel dialogue while sending up a thanks to my dad, the English prof.
I fear I am unwell, ma'am," I say. "Might I lie abed a while longer?"
I wince. I sound like a community theater player in a period drama. Even my voice isn't my own. It's the higher pitch I heard earlier with a thick Scottish brogue. As silence falls, I wonder whether I've laid on the historical novel speak a bit thick. More footsteps. These ones firm, soles smacking along the hall floor.
Sir, the older woman says. What the devil is going on? A man's voice, clipped with annoyance, his brogue softer.
It's Katrina, sir,
the girl says.
She's awake.
Awake? Genuine shock sparks in the man's voice. The knob jangles. The door opens an inch before I thump against it, forcing it shut.
She's barred the door, sir,
the girl, Alice, says again.
She's not herself.
The man mutters something I don't catch, and the older woman snorts. Katrina, he says, firm and abrupt, as if speaking to a dog. Open this door, or I will open it for you.
I am unwell, sir, and...
The door flies open, knocking me forward as a man strides into the room. About 30, he's big and rough-hewn, with a lantern jaw and broad shoulders. He must work in the stables, judging by the dirt on his rumpled clothing. Tousled black hair, dark beard shadow, brown skin. A thunderous look on his face that has me locking my knees to keep from shrinking back. He stalks across the room and yanks open heavy drapes, the gray light of a heavily clouded day filtering through. Then he turns on me. What the devil are you doing out of bed? He says. Get back in there now. Like hell? The words come before I can stop them, and his dark eyes widen. I hesitate. I want to fight, to demand answers. Where am I? What's going on? I know it isn't what I thought at first. This is not the guy who attacked me, and this is not some sicko killer's historical fantasy game. So what is it? I don't know, but my gut says to play along. Roll with it. Get answers without making trouble. Apologies, I say, in a tone that doesn't sound very apologetic.
I appear to have been struck in the head, and I am not quite myself.
Understatement of the century.
Pray tell, who might you be?
I might be your employer, Katrina.
Name?
A tiny gasp, and I look over to see the little girl, Alice, staring at me, goggle-eyed.
Your name, please, sir,
I say. Duncan Gray. Dr. Gray to you, the older woman says with a sniff. I glance at her. Her face says she isn't over 40, but she's steel-haired, with a glare to match. That is Mrs. Wallace, Gray continues. My housekeeper.
And I am?
His thick brows knit. You truly don't remember?
I fear I do not, sir, due to the bump on my head. If you would please kindly assist me by answering my questions, I would very much appreciate it.
You'll ask your questions of me, Mrs. Wallace snaps. The master has no time for your nonsense. Gray waves her off. His gaze still on me, peering, assessing. A medical doctor, then? I take a closer look at his shirt and see that what I'd mistaken for dirt is ink stains. Also, possibly a smear of soot. Wait, is that blood? Gray eases back. You are Katrina Mitchell, 19 years of age. Housemaid to myself and my widowed sister who is currently abroad.
And this place? Is your house, I presume, but the city? Edinburgh, is it?
Mrs. Wallace continues to glare as Alice watches me with that mixture of horror and admiration. As interrogations go, mine is downright civil. Probably still not quite appropriate for a Victorian housemaid. If Gray takes offense, though, he doesn't show it. Yes, it is my home. Yes, it is in Edinburgh. The faintest twitch of the lips. Scotland.
And the date, sir?
May 22nd. Before I can open my mouth, he adds, 1869. Today is May 22nd, 1869. Chapter 4. On May 20th, 1869, Katrina Mitchell had been enjoying a half day off, only to be discovered that night in a lane where she'd been strangled and left for dead. Exactly 150 years before I was strangled in the exact same spot. I woke mid-morning, and the rest of the day passes in a fog of denial pierced by bouts of investigation. I am, after all, a detective. Faced with a question, I investigate. I'm also the daughter of a defense attorney. I play both roles here. As a detective, I build my case, and as my mother's daughter, I try to tear it down again. What are the possibilities here? I could be dreaming, or being tricked, possibly drugged into hallucination. While it doesn't feel like those are the answers, I can't just trust my gut. The first step is to find something that doesn't fit the time period. For that, I automatically reach for my phone to start checking my surroundings against factual history. But without a cell phone, or any internet, I must rely on a layperson's understanding of the Victorian era. And I'm sure I could be fooled. Also, if it is a dream, it would match my expectations anyway. Still, I try to poke holes in the fabric of this reality. I check the mirror, in case it's a trick one. It isn't, and I'm not sure how that would work anyway when I can look down and see a body that's not my own. That takes me back to the drugged and hallucinating theory. I check my hair, not a wig or a weave. Nothing about me is familiar, and there is no chance I'm wearing some elaborate disguise. I check my undergarments next, which is an adventure in itself, in case I find modern underwear in the layers, suggesting a logical gap in the hallucination or dream. Nope. My underwear is definitely not modern. It's a pair of drawers. Wait, where's the crotch? I have two leg pieces attached and open at the crotch. Did I rip it? No. That seems to be the design. And I think I have indeed found a logical hole. Until I need to use the chamber pot with layers of skirts and I realize why my underwear would be crotchless. Okay. That I did not expect. I also test my mental faculties. I recite the alphabet backward. I walk in a straight line. I pull up the words to my favorite poems. I'm not drugged or inebriated in any way. When I woke, I presumed my attacker lured me into the alley with a video of a young woman being attacked. Forget the fact that I'm now in the body of that young woman. Does my theory even make sense? He's the guy from the coffee shop. He stalked me. What's the chance that he planted the video along my run in hopes I'd hear it and respond? No. What I heard was Katrina. What I saw was Katrina. My attacker only took advantage of it. I'd helpfully run into a dark alley, and that was exactly the opportunity he could not ignore. Later that morning, Alice brings me a late breakfast, which I can't bring myself to eat. Not until I've figured out what's going on. I manage to ask a few questions before she scampers off. Gray checks my head wound briefly. And come afternoon, Mrs. Wallace herself delivers lunch with a lecture, neither of which I'm in the mood for, but I pick at the food and pick through the lecture, mostly about how lucky I am to work for a family like this, for useful information. Then, Mrs. Wallace declaring me well enough, I moved upstairs to Katrina's proper quarters. When night falls, I slip from my room and head downstairs. There are a lot of stairs, with a lot of levels, which does make it seem like a dream, until I glance out a front window and realize we're in a townhouse. In Canada, that would mean a relatively small home, adjoined to others. This is as big as any suburban mini-mansion, at least 4,000 square feet. Three stories, plus a finished attic where the maids sleep, and a finished basement with the kitchen and Mrs. Wallace's quarters. When I first woke, I'd been in a third-floor guest room. Gray and his sister also have their bedrooms on that level. The second floor is home to the dining room, drawing room, and library. I'm not sure what's on the main level. The doors are locked, and I can't easily find anything to pick them. I conduct an otherwise thorough survey of the house, and I find nothing to suggest I'm not actually in the 19th century. Moreover, while I see many things I'd expect, I also see things that I don't expect. But on reflection, they fit. Like gas lighting and coal stoves. Ask me to imagine this period and I'd conjure up candles and wood fireplaces. I'm not sure I'd ever given much thought to what came between candles and electricity, or wood and oil furnaces. But gas and coal make sense. Also, the decorating is... I don't want to say ghastly. That oversells it. Slightly. There's too much of everything. From paintings to bric-a-brac to furniture. And Victorians obviously never met a bright color they didn't want for their sitting room. I'm saved from eye trauma by the gas lighting, which combines with the heavy drapes to keep the garish colors muted. I imagine the day when Victorians will get electric light, suddenly see their rooms in their full glory and run, screaming, retinas scarred. Again, it's not what I expected, but when I see it, my gut says, yes, this is Victorian. I poke about the house, and I track down Alice to subtly ask about the residence. Gray and his widowed sister live alone. The staff consists of Mrs. Wallace, Katrina, and Alice, plus a part-time gardener named Mr. Tull, and a stable hand named Simon. Between the staff and the elegant home, the family seems to be what I'd consider upper middle class. Oh, and Gray's not actually a doctor. Well, yes, technically he is. I found diplomas for a bachelor's degree in medicine, plus a master of surgery from the Royal College. But rather than keeping people alive, he takes care of them after they're dead. He's an undertaker, which seems to be an inherited family business. I spend that night investigating, while my internal defense lawyer challenges everything. Finally, it isn't my profession or my mother's that allows me to accept what has happened to me. It's Nan's. She's an amateur folklorist who grew up in a family where they'd put out cream for the fairies. If asked whether she believed in such things herself, she'd say, I don't not believe. She'd heard too many stories to slam that door shut. Real fairies? Maybe not. But she did allow for the possibility of concepts beyond the conventional realm of science, like ghosts and telekinesis, and time travel. In the end, I cannot dismiss the words of that fictional saint of detectives. When you have eliminated the impossible, whatever remains, however improbable, must be the truth. Something happened in that lane. Two women were strangled 150 years apart, on the same night, in the same spot. I don't think I heard and saw an echo of the attack on Katrina. I think I saw the attack itself, through a rip in time. I heard her cries. I came running. And when I was attacked in the same manner, time tangled and I fell into her. Is Katrina in my body? Lying in a 21st century hospital bed? If I get back to where we switched places, can I reverse this? I will get back there. Right now, though, there's no escaping. During the day, I played confused and befuddled head injury victim, which also gave me an excuse for staying in my bed, recuperating as I worked out my situation. Otherwise, I suspect Mrs. Wallace would have put me to work as soon as I woke. Once I've accepted time travel as the answer, I head straight to the front door before realizing I have no idea where I am and how to get back to that lane. My brain insists that isn't a problem. Just pull out my phone and let the GPS guide me back to the grass market. Yeah. While the front door is locked, it doesn't require a key to open from the inside, so it's not as if I'm trapped. I'll acquire more data before venturing out. Mrs. Wallace has already declared I'll resume my duties tomorrow. That's fine. It's the only way I'll get the information I need to return to the lane where I passed through time. Playing housemaid is a necessary evil. If I want to avoid being tossed into a lunatic asylum for my odd behavior. Here, I have food and shelter and a job that can't be all that difficult. Everyone expects me to be a little off after my injury. I'll be as sweet and demure as any Victorian maiden, as quiet as they'll expect from a servant girl, while I figure things out. I have a mission, one with three simple steps. Find my way back, get to Nan's side before it's too late, give the police everything I know to stop a killer. It feels like the middle of the night when Mrs. Wallace bangs her fist on my door. I reach for my phone to check the time, and my hand smacks down on an empty nightstand. "It's almost 5, she says as she sticks her head in. "Are you going to lay about till dawn?" Sorry, I say, my voice thankfully muffled as I rephrase that. "Apologies, ma'am. I seem to have misplaced my alarm clock." Her broad face scrunches up.
"Your what?"
I cough. How do Victorians wake up if they haven't invented alarm clocks? "Apologies, ma'am," I repeat. "'Twill not happen again." Her eyes narrow, as if I'm being sarcastic. She shakes it off and says, "Get your lazy bones out of that bed. I'll expect you dressed and downstairs in a quarter hour, or you'll not be getting any tea." She smacks the door closed. I groan. It's been clear from our brief interactions that Mrs. Wallace is not a Katrina fan. I don't know whether it's a personality clash or simply a product of the times, where women have so little power that they wield it against one another with unnecessary vigor. Unnecessary vigor? I smile to myself. Even my internal dialogue is starting to sound positively Victorian. That's the trick, really. Stilted speech. $5 words. Thanks to Dad, I know plenty of those. And for God's sake, do not mention things before they were invented. Of course, the problem is that I don't know when they were invented. For the 1,000th time in 2 days, I find myself reaching for my phone to look it up. I've been able to do that since I was a kid. And now I feel lost without that easy access to a virtual universe of data. You're a detective. Figure it out. Yep. Think before I speak. Err on the side of caution. I'm a maid. No one will expect me to say much. At least I've retained Katrina's voice and accent. That will help. Otherwise, each word should be uttered with care and forethought, until I'm certain I'm not referring to an object 20 years before its time. I do know one thing that hasn't been invented. Central heating. As I discovered last night, while the house is mostly heated by coal, there are still a couple of wood-burning fireplaces. In my room, there's a small coal one, a brazier, which I'm sure will do a lovely job once I figure out how to use it. So, my room is freezing, despite me closing the window. There's no shortage of blankets, thank God. But once I throw back the covers, it's like stepping into a walk-in freezer. I reach for my bedside lamp, only to remember it's oil. My shaking fingers struggle to light it. My room has gas lighting, but Mrs. Wallace caught me using it yesterday and gave me hell. Apparently, having gas lighting and being allowed to use it are two different things. At least, if you're a mere housemaid. My quarters are the size of a college dorm room, with a narrow bed and tiny window. A dorm, or a prison cell. It's a private room, though, with a locking door, and from what I've seen of servants' rooms in movies, I struck gold here. I pull on my uniform easily enough. I practiced yesterday, so I wouldn't take an hour getting ready this morning. The damned corset isn't even the worst of it. There's layer upon layer of clothing. I might have been cursing those layers yesterday, but this morning I happily tug them on. At least they'll keep me warm. Maybe that's the point. Next come my morning ablutions. I think that's the word, anyway. It sounds properly old-fashioned. I have an old college friend who adores historical romance novels, and I take every opportunity to remind her that those dashing dukes would have had yellow teeth and stunk of B.O. Judging by Gray and his staff, that's not true. And I don't know whether Victorian hygiene levels are higher than I expected, or they're just higher in a doctor's home. Dental hygiene is not as dire as I feared. Katrina has a bristled brush in her toiletries and a powder that I use to brush with, while hoping I haven't mistaken its purpose and will drop dead of arsenic poisoning. Of course, having no idea what's even in Victorian tooth powder, I might still drop dead of it. But at least my teeth will be clean. I finish getting ready with a bristle hairbrush, soap, and clean water. It'd be even better if that water weren't ice cold, but at least it wakes me up. I'm still washing my face when the downstairs clock strikes the quarter hour. Shit. I mean, drat. Ugh, no. Pretty sure that isn't historically accurate either. In fact, I have the very strong impression that demure young housemaids do not use profanity, at least not out loud. I race into the hall only to hear a squeak of surprise and turn to see Alice blinking at me. Okay, apparently demure young housemaids do not tear down halls either. I bend a quick curtsy in apology and her eyes widen in shock. Right, housemaids wouldn't curtsy to other maids. That's for the master and mistress of the house. Or is curtsying even a thing in 1869? I wave to Alice, who lifts her fingers hesitantly. Do people not wave in Victorian Scotland? God damn it, this isn't going to be half as easy as I thought. It isn't just modern speech and modern references I need to avoid. It's modern gestures, modern customs, modern everything. And the longer I fret about that, the later I'll be for starting work. I suspect Mrs. Wallace wasn't joking about missing breakfast. I only need to suffer through a day or two in service before I'll have what I need to get home. I take the stairs down 4 flights to the basement kitchen. It's a small room, blazing hot and as clean as a surgery, with a horror movie's worth of hanging knives. The smell, fresh bread, hot tea, roast ham, gets my stomach rumbling, and I hurry for the door into the servants' hall where we eat. "Do you expect to be served your tea, Miss Katrina?" That's when I see the tray on the counter. A steaming teapot, slices of fresh-baked bread, tiny silver and glass bowls of butter and pickled something. There's also an empty plate for the ham and poached eggs cooking on the stove. I head for the tray as my stomach growls in appreciation. I'll say this much for 19th century Scotland. The food has been better than I expected. I'm reaching for the breakfast tray when Mrs. Wallace says, "I'm not done with that yet. Drink your tea and give me time to finish his eggs." His eggs. This is Gray's breakfast. "Apologies, ma'am," I say, and resist the urge to curtsy. "And where might my morning meal be?" I follow her gaze to a cup of tea and a chunk of unbuttered fresh bread. I glance from her to the meager meal, hoping I'm misunderstanding. Nope. Well, at least it's not stale bread and water. I devour the food, trying very hard not to wolf it down like a starving beast. Crossing 150 years takes a lot out of a person, and that chunk of bread only whets my appetite. Once it's gone, I turn to Mrs. Wallace, feeling like Oliver Twist, holding out my plate. "Please, ma'am, might I have another slice?"
"And let Dr. Gray's breakfast go cold. You'll get your meal after the master has had his."
I must look relieved, because she waves at my empty bread plate.
"Did you think I'd stop feeding you? I run a proper household. You'll need a full belly if you're going to get through your chores. The mistress comes home in 2 days and you've been slacking, Miss Katrina."
"I was unconscious."
"Not since yesterday."
She scoops the poached eggs into tiny silver cups.
"Now, get your lazy self off and start working."
I head toward what I hope is a room in need of cleaning. She clears her throat.
"Are you forgetting something?"
When I glance over, her gaze goes to the meal tray. I glance from it to her.
You want me to take this to Dr. Gray?
No. I'd like it to fly up to him on pixie wings. But as you're the only one here, I suppose you'll have to do. I fix on my most contrite look, lashes lowered.
Apologies, ma'am. I know I'm being a trial. My mind is still a wee bit fuzzy after my accident.
Oh, is that how you're going to play this? She raises her voice to a falsetto.
I'm a wee bit fuzzy, ma'am. If I could just have an extra day or two to rest.
She shoves the tray into my hands. Be glad you still have a position at all, after getting yourself into that mess.
Getting myself strangled?
You were skulking about the old town. What do you expect?
The old town?
If I remember correctly, in this era, that was the slums. So what was a housemaid from a prosperous household doing there? Mrs. Wallace continues. Now, take that tray to the master before it's cold, and as soon as he's done with you, get yourself back here and I might have breakfast for you.
Chapter 5. As I take the tray up the stairs, one smell rises above the others. Is that... I inhale. Wafting from the teapot is the distinct smell of coffee. Drool tickles the corners of my mouth. They have coffee in 1869?
I don't mind tea, but right now that coffee smells more tantalizing than the entire breakfast combined. I twist the tray so I can inhale the fumes directly, as I wonder whether Gray would miss a few sips. I imagine Mrs. Wallace coming around the corner to see me drinking straight out of the master's coffee pot. Maybe if I'm the one to collect it, there will be some left. Yep, my first day as a housemaid, and I'm already reduced to stealing the dregs of my master's coffee. Also, master? Is that really what he's called? I suppose it's the alternative, when we can't refer to him as his lordship or whatever. Still, I hope to hell I'm not expected to call him master. Gray's bedroom is on the third floor. That's 3 flights of stairs up. I continue climbing as I remind myself I'm in need of a good workout. Maybe I can go out for a run on my break. As I think that, my long skirts catch my knees, and I look down. Nope. No jogging in this outfit. I crest the stairs and... shit. Which door is his? A chair scrapes against the floor and I exhale. I can do this. Detective, remember? Follow the clues. As I prepare to enter the room, I try to remember whether I've seen or read this scene. A housemaid bringing breakfast to her employer. It's familiar, but the details are lost to memory. Information I never expected to use, oddly enough. I think I'm supposed to knock first. Either way, that seems safe. I pause to pull on my best speaking to the Lord face. Demure. That's the key. I'm a Victorian housemaid. Keep my gaze down and my expression meek. Be seen but not heard. Or is that for children? Close enough. I rap on the door. After a moment, there's a grunt that I think means, come in. I ease the door partway open, and a low table appears just to my left. I set the tray on it and murmur, your breakfast, sir, and then begin my retreat. Where the devil are you going? I open the door to see Gray at a desk. He isn't fully dressed. He's decent, at least by 21st century standards. Button-down shirt, mostly fastened, the Victorian equivalent of boxers, undergarments that reach to his knees. If they're crotchless drawers like mine, that particular part is well hidden by his shirt. Long socks cover most of the remaining skin. Well, one sock. The other is on the floor. If he wasn't at his desk, pen in hand, I'd think I'd interrupted him in the midst of dressing. From the looks of things, it's an idea that interrupted him, and he stopped halfway through to scribble it down.
Well, he says,
the words spoken with an impatient snap. I'm obviously in need of your services, Katrina.
I freeze. Now, this is a scene I have definitely read in books. The pretty young maid, forced to tend to the lord of the manor? Oh, hell no. You even hint at that, Dr. Gray, and I'll take my chances on the street.
He looks from me to the darkened fireplace, and then back at me.
Well?
Oh, you want me to light the fire?
No, Miss Katrina. I want you to warm the room with your sunny disposition.
Yes, I want you to start the fire, preferably before I freeze to death.
Well, if you're cold, maybe you could finish getting dressed. Or light your own damn fire.
That's exactly what I'd say if a superior officer expected me to light a fire while he lounged half naked. Well, no, I'd tell him to get his pants on before I reported his ass. But Gray employs me to do exactly this. I need to treat it as good practice for going undercover. Bite my tongue, swallow my attitude, and act a part.
I realize this is your first day back to work, he says. I am making allowances for that. But I will expect my fire lit before I rise tomorrow.
What time is that, sir?
His dark eyes narrow.
The same as always. 5:30.
Oh, joy.
Apparently, I need to get up before 5 now, right after I figure out how the hell to do that without an alarm clock. I murmur something suitably agreeable and then move to the fire. It's a wood-burning fireplace, not coal. The master of the house values ambiance over convenience, apparently. Helps when you have staff to light it for you. I can do this. I was a girl guide, and I go camping every year with friends. Well, I did, until I got too busy with work and had to recuse myself from the annual getaway. 1 year off fire-making shouldn't matter. Or is it 2 years?
Possibly 3. Damn it. I've let things slide. Let life slide.
I'm going to fix that when I get back. Repair the damage before I stop getting invitations. And suddenly I'm 40 and wondering why no one calls me anymore. For now, though, I've got this. Just start a fire. I stare at the mess in the fireplace. All ashes and scorched wood. Then I spend the next 20 minutes cleaning the fireplace. Gray has resumed his mad scribbling, so absorbed that the only time he even glances over is when I drop the metal poker on the stone hearth.
Less clatter would be appreciated, Katrina.
I murmur an apology. There's silence, and I think he's gone back to work, but then he says, dryly,
I don't believe you're supposed to clean the hearth with your skirt.
I look down. I'm wearing a uniform, a white apron over a dark blue dress. That apron is no longer white. Neither is the surrounding fabric. I could argue that he's not one to judge. I already see ink spatter on his collar. But I suspect rejoinders are not permitted in this relationship. I lean back on my heels.
I'm not quite myself, sir.
I've noticed.
I take a deep breath and make a decision. A risky one.
My memory seems to have been adversely affected by my illness, and I find myself struggling to recall mundane and ordinary tasks.
He stares at me like I'm speaking Greek. I replay my words, but they seem fine. Suitably stilted and old-fashioned. Maybe it's my accent? It's thicker than his.
I realize this is unseemly of me, I say, being a maid, but I must humbly request your forbearance.
More brow wrinkling, now accompanied by what looks like suspicion. I hurry on.
I'm not trying to weasel. I'm not asking to be excused from my task, sir. I understand my convalescence has been an inconvenience, upsetting the smooth operation of your household. I am simply admitting that I may require reminders now and then of my tasks, which I will complete forthwith.
Forthwith, he repeats slowly.
Isn't that the right word? It sounds right.
I continue. Promptly and efficiently, with the diligence you expect of your staff.
I see.
His look is bemusement bordering on bafflement.